Chapter 19. After so wide a compass as I have wandered, I do now gladly overtake, and close in with my subject, and shall henceforth hold on with it an even pace to the end of my journey, except some beautiful prospect appears within sight of my way, whereof, though at present I have neither warning nor expectation, yet upon such an accident, come when it will, I shall beg my reader's favor and company, allowing me to conduct him through it along with myself. For in writing it is as in traveling. If a man is in haste, to be at home, which I acknowledge to be none of my case, having never so little business as when I am there, if his horse be tired with long riding and ill ways, or be naturally a jade, I advise him clearly, to make the straightest and the commonest road, be it ever so dirty. But then surely we must own such a man, to be a scurvy companion at best. He spatters himself and his fellow travelers at every step. All their thoughts, and wishes, and conversation turn entirely upon the subject of their journey's end, and at every splash, and plunge, and stumble they heartily wish one another at the devil. On the other side, when a traveler and his horse are in heart and plight, when his purse is full, and the day before him, he takes the road, only where it is clean or convenient, entertains his company there as agreeably as he can, but upon the first occasion carries them along with him to every delightful scene in view, whether of art, of nature, or of both. And if they chance to refuse out of stupidity or weariness, let them jog on by themselves, and be d'. He'll overtake them at the next town, at which arriving, he rides furiously through, the men, women, and children run out to gaze, 100 noisy curs run barking after him, of which, if he honors the boldest with a lash of his whip, it is rather out of sport than revenge. But should some sour mongrel dare too near an approach, he receives a salute on the chaps by an accidental stroke from the courser's heels, nor is any ground lost by the blow, which sends him yelping and limping home. I now proceed to sum up the singular adventures of my renowned Jack, the state of whose dispositions and fortunes the careful reader does, no doubt, most exactly remember, as I last parted with him in the conclusion of a former section. Therefore, his next care must be from two of the foregoing, to extract a scheme of notions that may best fit his understanding for a true relish of what is to ensue. Jack had not only calculated the first revolution of his brain so prudently as to give rise to that epidemic sect of idealists, but succeeding also into a new and strange variety of conceptions, the fruitfulness of his imagination led him into certain notions which, although in appearance very unaccountable, were not without their mysteries and their meanings, nor wanted followers to countenance and improve them. I shall therefore be extremely careful and exact in recounting such material passages of this nature as I have been able to collect either from undoubted tradition or indefatigable reading, and shall describe them as graphically as it is possible, and as far as notions of that height and latitude can be brought within the compass of a pen. Nor do I at all question but they will furnish plenty of noble matter for such whose converting imaginations dispose them to reduce all things into types, who can make shadows no thanks to the sun and then mold them into substances no thanks to philosophy, whose peculiar talent lies in fixing tropes and allegories to the letter, and refining what is literal into figure and mystery. Jack had provided a fair copy of his father's will, engrossed in form upon a large skin of parchment, and resolving to act the part of a most dutiful son, he became the fondest creature of it imaginable. For although, as I have often told the reader, it consisted wholly in certain plain, easy directions about the management and wearing of their coats, with legacies and penalties in case of obedience or neglect, yet he began to entertain a fancy that the matter was deeper and darker, and therefore must needs have a great deal more of mystery at the bottom. "Gentlemen," said he, "I will prove this very skin of parchment to be meat, drink, and cloth, to be the philosopher's stone and the universal medicine. and consequence of which raptures he resolved to make use of it in the most necessary as well as the most paltry occasions of life. He had a way of working it into any shape he pleased, so that it served him for a nightcap when he went to bed, and for an umbrella in rainy weather. He would lap a piece of it about a sore toe, or, when he had fits, burn 2 inches under his nose. Or, if anything lay heavy on his stomach, scrape off and swallow as much of the powder as would lie on a silver penny. They were all infallible remedies. With analogy to these refinements, his common talk and conversation ran wholly in the praise of his will, and he circumscribed the utmost of his eloquence within that compass, not daring to let slip a syllable without authority from thence. Once at a strange house he was suddenly taken short upon an urgent juncture, whereon it may not be allowed too particularly to dilate, and being not able to call to mind, with that suddenness the occasion required, an authentic phrase for demanding the way to the back, he chose rather, as the more prudent course, to incur the penalty in such cases usually annexed. Neither was it possible for the united rhetoric of mankind to prevail with him to make himself clean again, because, having consulted the will upon this emergency, he met with a passage near the bottom, whether foisted in by the transcriber, is not known, which seemed to forbid it. 145. He made it a part of his religion never to say grace to his meat, nor could all the world persuade him, as the common phrase is, to eat his victuals like a Christian. 145b. He bore a strange kind of appetite to snapdragon, and to the livid snuffs of a burning candle. 146. Which he would catch, and swallow with an agility wonderful to conceive, and by this procedure, maintained a perpetual flame in his belly, which issuing in a glowing steam from both his eyes, as well as his nostrils and his mouth, made his head appear in a dark night like the skull of an ass wherein a roguish boy hath conveyed a farthing candle, to the terror of his majesty's liege subjects. Therefore he made use of no other expedient to light himself home, but was wont to say that a wise man was his own lanthorn. He would shut his eyes as he walked along the streets, and if he happened to bounce his head against a post, or fall into the kennel, as he seldom missed either, to do one or both, he would tell the jibing apprentices who looked on, that he submitted with entire resignation, as to a trip or a blow of fate, with whom he found by long experience, how vain it was either to wrestle or to cuff, and whoever durst undertake to do either would be sure to come off with a swinging fall or a bloody nose. He was ordained, said he, 146b, some few days before the creation, that my nose and this very post should have a rencounter, and therefore Providence thought fit to send us both into the world in the same age, and to make us countrymen and fellow citizens. Now, had my eyes been open, it is very likely the business might have been a great deal worse, for how many a confounded slip is daily got by man with all his foresight about him. Besides, the eyes of the understanding see best when those of the senses are out of the way, and therefore blind men are observed to tread their steps with much more caution and conduct and judgment than those who rely with too much confidence upon the virtue of the visual nerve, which every little accident shakes out of order, and a drop or a film can wholly disconcert. Like a lanthorn among a pack of roaring bullies, when they scour the streets, exposing its owner and itself to outward kicks and buffets, which both might have escaped, if the vanity of appearing would have suffered them to walk in the dark. But further, if we examine the conduct of these boasted lights, it will prove, yet a great deal worse than their fortune. It is true I have broke my nose against this post, because Providence either forgot, or did not think it convenient, to twitch me by the elbow, and give me notice to avoid it. But let not this encourage either the present age of posterity, to trust their noses unto the keeping of their eyes, which may prove the fairest way of losing them for good and all. For, O ye eyes, ye blind guides, miserable guardians are ye of our frail noses. Ye, I say, who fasten upon the first precipice in view, and then tow our wretched willing bodies after you to the very brink of destruction. But alas! That brink is rotten, our feet slip, and we tumble down prone into a gulf, without one hospitable shrub in the way, to break the fall, a fall to which not any nose of mortal make is equal, except that of the giant Lurkalko 147, who was lord of the Silver Bridge. Most properly, therefore, O eyes, and with great justice, may you be compared to those foolish lights which conduct men through dirt and darkness till they fall into a deep, bitter, and noisome bog. This I have produced as a scantling of Jack's great eloquence, and the force of his reasoning upon such abstruse matters. He was, besides, a person of great design and improvement in affairs of devotion, having introduced a new deity, who has since met with a vast number of worshippers, by some called Babel, by others Chaos, who had an ancient temple of Gothic structure upon Salisbury Plain, famous for its shrine and celebration by pilgrims. When he had some roguish trick to play, he would down with his knees, up with his eyes, and fall to prayers, though in the midst of the kennel. Then it was that those who understood his pranks would be sure to get far enough out of his way, and whenever curiosity attracted strangers, to laugh or to listen, he would of a sudden bespatter them with mud. In winter he went always loose and unbuttoned, and clad as thin as possible to let in the ambient heat, and in summer lapped himself close, and thick to keep it out. 147b. In all revolutions of government, he would make his court for the office of hangman general, and in the exercise of that dignity, wherein he was very dexterous, would make use of no other wizard than a long prayer. He had a tongue, so musculous and subtle, that he could twist it up into his nose, and deliver a strange kind of speech from thence. He was also the first in these kingdoms who began to improve the Spanish accomplishment of braying, and having large ears perpetually exposed and erected, he carried his art to such a perfection, that it was a point of great difficulty, to distinguish either by the view, or the sound between the original and the copy. He was troubled with a disease the reverse to that called the stinging of the tarantula, and would run dog mad at the noise of music, especially a pair of bagpipes. 148. But he would cure himself again by taking two or three turns in Westminster Hall, or Billingsgate, or in a boarding school, or the Royal Exchange, or a state coffee house. He was a person that feared no colors, but mortally hated all, and upon that account bore a cruel aversion to painters, insomuch that in his paroxysms as he walked the streets, he would have his pockets loaded with stones, to pelt at the signs. 148b. Having from his manner of living frequent occasions to wash himself, he would often leap over head and ears into the water, though it were in the midst of the winter, but was always observed to come out again much dirtier, if possible, than he went in. 148c. He was the first that ever found out the secret of contriving a soporiferous medicine to be conveyed in at the ears. 148d. It was a compound of sulfur and balm of Gilead, with a little pilgrim's salve. He wore a large plaster of artificial caustics on his stomach, with the fervor of which he could set himself a groaning like the famous board upon application of a red-hot iron. He would stand in the turning of a street, and calling to those who passed by, would cry to one, "Worthy sir, do me the honor of a good slap in the chaps," to another, "Honest friend, pray favor me with a handsome kick in the rear. Madam, shall I entreat a small box in the ear from your ladyship's fair hands? Oble captain, lend a reasonable thwack, for the love of God, with that cane of yours over these poor shoulders." And when he had by such earnest solicitations made a shift to procure a basting sufficient to swell up his fancy and his sides, he would return home extremely comforted, and full of terrible accounts of what he had undergone for the public good. "Serve this stroke," said he, showing his bare shoulders. "A plague-eyed janissary gave it me this very morning at 7 o'clock, as, with much ado, I was driving off the Great Turk. neighbor's mine. This broken head deserves a plaster. Had poor Jack been tender of his noddle, you would have seen the Pope and the French King long before this time of day among your wives and your warehouses. Dear Christians, the great Mogul was come as far as Whitechapel, and you may thank these poor sights, that he hath not, God bless us, already swallowed up man, woman, and child. It was highly worth observing the singular effects of that aversion or antipathy which Jack and his brother Peter seemed, even to affectation, to bear towards each other. Peter had lately done some rogueries that forced him to abscond, and he seldom ventured to stir out before night for fear of bailiffs. Their lodgings were at the two most distant parts of the town from each other, and whenever their occasions or humors called them abroad, they would make choice of the oddest unlikely times, and most uncouth rounds, that they could invent, that they might be sure to avoid one another. Yet, after all this, it was their perpetual fortune to meet, the reason of which is easy enough to apprehend. For the frenzy and the spleen of both having the same foundation, we may look upon them as two pair of compasses equally extended, and the fixed foot of each remaining in the same center, which, though moving contrary ways at first, will be sure to encounter somewhere or other in the circumference. Besides, it was among the great misfortunes of Jack to bear a huge personal resemblance with his brother Peter. Their humor and dispositions were not only the same, but there was a close analogy in their shape, their size, and their mien, insomuch as nothing was more frequent than for a bailiff to seize Jack by the shoulders and cry, "Mr. Peter, you are the king's prisoner," or, at other times, for one of Peter's nearest friends to accost Jack with open arms. "Dear Peter, I am glad to see thee. Pray send me one of your best medicines for the worms." This, we may suppose, was a mortifying return of those pains and proceedings Jack had labored in so long, and finding how directly opposite all his endeavors had answered to the sole end and intention which he had proposed to himself, how could it avoid having terrible effects upon a head and heart so furnished as his? However, the poor remainders of his coat bore all the punishment. The Orient Sun never entered upon his diurnal progress without missing a piece of it. He hired a tailor to stitch up the collar so close that it was ready to choke him, and squeezed out his eyes at such a rate as one could see nothing but the white. What little was left of the main substance of the coat he rubbed every day for 2 hours against a rough cast wall, in order to grind away the remnants of lace and embroidery, but at the same time, went on with so much violence that he preceded a heathen philosopher. Yet after all he could do of this kind, the success continued still to disappoint his expectation, for as it is the nature of rags to bear a kind of mock resemblance to finery, there being a sort of fluttering appearance in both, which is not to be distinguished at a distance in the dark, or by short-sighted eyes, so in those junctures it fared with Jack and his tatters, that they offered to the first view a ridiculous flaunting, which, assisting the resemblance in person and air, thwarted all his projects of separation, and left so near a similitude between them as frequently deceived the very disciples and followers of both. Desent non nulla. The old Sclavonian proverb said well, that it is with men as with asses. Whoever would keep them fast must find a very good hold at their ears. Yet I think we may affirm, and it hath been verified by repeated experience, that dash, effugiat tamen hic celeritas vincula pradis. 151. It is good, therefore, to read the maxims of our ancestors with great allowances to times and persons, for if we look into primitive records we shall find that no revolutions have been so great or so frequent as those of human ears. In former days there was a curious invention to catch and keep them, which I think we may justly reckon among the arts perdidi. And how can it be otherwise, when in these latter centuries the very species is not only diminished to a very lamentable degree, but the poor remainder is also degenerated so far as to mock our skillfulest tenure? For if only the slitting of one. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.